This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1. RC-37678. Disclosure by Michael Crichton. Copyright 1993 by Michael Crichton. All rights reserved. Read by Chuck Benson. This book contains 397 pages on 9 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. Tom Sanders, a manager at a high-tech company, is on the way up the corporate ladder. But Meredith Johnson, a former lover, gets the position that he expected and tries to show Tom who is boss. Spurned, Meredith accuses Tom of sexual harassment. He hires a female lawyer with expertise in sexual misconduct cases and scans the computer files for evidence of Meredith's manipulative ability. Strong language and some explicit descriptions of sex. Bestseller, 1993. From the book jacket. A brutal struggle in the cutthroat computer industry. A shattering psychological game of cat and mouse. An accusation of sexual harassment that threatens to derail a brilliant career. This is the electrifying core of Michael Crichton's new novel, his first since Rising Sun. At the center, Tom Sanders, an up-and-coming executive with Digicom in Seattle, a man whose corporate future is certain. Until, after a closed-door meeting with his new boss, a woman who was his lover 10 years before, a woman who has been promoted to the position he expected to have, he is accused of sexually harassing her. Now, as he scrambles to defend himself, enlisting the help of a sagacious woman lawyer whose career has been built on the successful prosecution of men charged with sexual misconduct, he finds himself trapped between what he knows to be true and what he knows others will assume to be the truth. And, as he uncovers an electronic trail into the company's secrets, he begins to grasp just how cynical and manipulative and abusive truth has actually occurred. Tackling one of the most divisive issues of our time, disclosure compels us to see beyond our traditional responses. It is Michael Crichton at his galvanizing best. About the author. Michael Crichton was born in Chicago in 1942. He was educated at Harvard College and the Harvard Medical School. His novels include The Andromeda Strain, The Terminal Man, The Great Train Robbery, Eaters of the Dead, Congo, Sphere, Jurassic Park, and Rising Sun. He is also the author of 4 works of nonfiction: Five Patients, Jasper Johns, Electronic Life, and Travels. Among the films he has directed are Westworld, Coma, and the movie version of his own, The Great Train Robbery. This is a work of fiction. Characters and corporations in this novel are either the product of the author's imagination or, if real, used fictitiously without any intent to describe their actual conduct. For Douglas Crichton. It shall be an unlawful employment practice for an employer: 1. To fail or refuse to hire or to discharge any individual, or otherwise to discriminate against any individual with respect to his compensation, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Or 2. To limit, segregate, or classify his employees or applicants for employment in any way which would deprive or tend to deprive any individual of employment opportunities or otherwise adversely affect his status as an employee because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Title 7, Civil Rights Act of 1964. Power is neither male nor female. Catherine Graham. Monday. From DCM, Arthur Kahn. Twinkle, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. To DCS, Tom Sanders, Seattle, at home. Tom, considering the merger, I thought you should get this at home and not the office. Twinkle production lines running at 29% capacity despite all efforts to increase. Spot checks on drives show average seek times in 120 to 140 millisecond range, with no clear indication why we are not stable at specs. Also, we still have power flicker in screens, which appears to come from hinge design despite implementation of DCS fix last week. I don't think it's solved yet. How's the merger coming? Are we going to be rich and famous? Congratulations in advance on your promotion. Arthur. Tom Sanders never intended to be late for work on Monday, June 15th. At 7:30 in the morning, he stepped into the shower at his home on Bainbridge Island. He knew he had to shave, dress, and leave the house in 10 minutes if he was to make the 7:50 ferry and arrive at work by 8:30, in time to go over the remaining points with Stephanie Kaplan before they went into the meeting with the lawyers from Conley White. He already had a full day at work, and the facts he had just received from Malaysia made it worse. Sanders was a division manager at Digital Communications Technology in Seattle. Events at work had been hectic for a week because Digicom was being acquired by Conley White, a publishing conglomerate in New York. The merger would allow Conley to acquire technology important to publishing in the next century. But this latest news from Malaysia was not good, and Arthur had been right to send it to him at home. He was going to have a problem explaining it to the Conley White people because they just didn't... Tom? Where are you? Tom? His wife Susan was calling from the bedroom. He ducked his head out of the spray. I'm in the shower. She said something in reply, but he didn't hear it. He stepped out, reaching for a towel. What? I said, can you feed the kids? His wife was an attorney who worked 4 days a week at a downtown firm. She took Mondays off to spend more time with the kids, but she was not good at managing the routine at home. As a result, there was often a crisis on Monday mornings. Tom, can you feed them for me? I can't, Sue, he called to her. The clock on the sink said 7:34. I'm already late. He ran water in the basin to shave and lathered his face. He was a handsome man with the easy manner of an athlete. He touched the dark bruise on his side from the company touch football game on Saturday. Mark Lewin had taken him down. Lewin was fast but clumsy, and Sanders was getting too old for touch football. He was still in good shape, still within 5 pounds of his varsity weight, but as he ran his hand through his wet hair, he saw streaks of gray. It was time to admit his age, he thought, and switch to tennis. Susan came into the room, still in her bathrobe. His wife always looked beautiful in the morning, right out of bed. She had the kind of fresh beauty that required no makeup. Are you sure you can't feed them? She said. Oh, nice bruise. Very butch. She kissed him lightly and pushed a fresh mug of coffee onto the counter for him. I've got to get Matthew to the pediatrician by 8:15, and neither one of them has eaten a thing, and I'm not dressed. Can't you please feed them? Pretty please? Teasing, she ruffled his hair and her bathrobe fell open. She left it open and smiled. I'll owe you one. Sue, I can't. He kissed her forehead distractedly. I've got a meeting. I can't be late. She sighed. Oh, all right. Pouting, she left. Sanders began shaving. A moment later, he heard his wife say, Okay, kids, let's go. Eliza, put your shoes on. This was followed by whining from Eliza, who was 4 and didn't like to wear shoes. Sanders had almost finished shaving when he heard, Eliza, you put on those shoes and take your brother downstairs right now. Eliza's reply was indistinct, and then Susan said, Eliza Ann, I'm talking to you. Then Susan began slamming drawers in the hall linen closet. Both kids started to cry. Eliza, who was upset by any display of tension, came into the bathroom, her face scrunched up, tears in her eyes. Daddy, she sobbed. He put his hand down to hug her, still shaving with his other hand. She's old enough to help out, Susan called from the hallway. Mommy, she wailed, clutching Sanders' leg. Eliza, will you cut it out? At this, Eliza cried more loudly. Susan stamped her foot in the hallway. Sanders hated to see his daughter cry. Okay, Sue, I'll feed them. He turned off the water in the sink and scooped up his daughter. "Come on, Lise," he said, wiping away her tears. "Let's get you some breakfast." He went out into the hallway. Susan looked relieved. "I just need 10 minutes, that's all," she said. "Consuela is late again. I don't know what's the matter with her." Sanders didn't answer her. His son Matt, who was 9 months old, sat in the middle of the hallway banging his rattle and crying. Sanders scooped him up in his other arm. "Come on, kids," he said, "let's go eat." When he picked up Matt, his towel slipped off, and he clutched at it. Eliza giggled. "I see your penis, Dad." She swung her foot, kicking it. "We don't kick Daddy there," Sanders said. Awkwardly, he wrapped the towel around himself again and headed downstairs. Susan called after him. "Don't forget Matt needs vitamins in his cereal, 1 dropperful, and don't give him any more of the rice cereal. He spits it out. He likes wheat now." She went into the bathroom, slamming the door behind her. His daughter looked at him with serious eyes. "Is this going to be one of those days, Daddy?" "Yeah, it looks like it." He walked down the stairs, thinking he would miss the ferry and that he would be late for the first meeting of the day. Not very late, just a few minutes, but it meant he wouldn't be able to go over things with Stephanie before they started. But perhaps he could call her from the ferry, and then...
"Do I have a penis, Dad?"
"No lies."
"Why, Dad?"
"That's just the way it is, honey." "Boys have penises and girls have vaginas," she said solemnly. "That's right."
"Why, Dad?"
"Because." He dropped his daughter on a chair at the kitchen table, dragged the high chair from the corner, and placed Matt in it. "What do you want for breakfast, Lise? Rice Krispies or Chex?"
"Chex."
Matt began to bang on his high chair with his spoon. Sanders got the Chex and a bowl out of the cupboard, then the box of wheat cereal and a smaller bowl for Matt. Eliza watched him as he opened the refrigerator to get the milk.
"Dad?"
"What?"
"I want Mommy to be happy."
"Me too, honey." He mixed the wheat cereal for Matt and put it in front of his son. Then he set Eliza's bowl on the table, poured in the Chex, glanced at her. "Enough?"
"Yes."
He poured the milk for her.
"No, Dad!"
His daughter howled, bursting into tears. "I wanted to pour the milk." "Sorry, Lise."
"Take it out. Take the milk out."
She was shrieking, completely hysterical. "I'm sorry, Lise, but this is..."
"I wanted to pour the milk."
She slid off her seat to the ground, where she lay kicking her heels on the floor.
"Take it out. Take the milk out."
His daughter did this kind of thing several times a day. It was, he was assured, just a phase. Parents were advised to treat it with firmness. "I'm sorry," Sanders said. "You'll just have to eat it, Lise." He sat down at the table beside Matt to feed him. Matt stuck his hand in his cereal and smeared it across his eyes. He, too, began to cry. Sanders got a dish towel to wipe Matt's face. He noticed that the kitchen clock now said 5 to 8. He thought that he'd better call the office to warn them that he would be late. But he'd have to quiet Eliza first. She was still on the floor, kicking and screaming about the milk. "All right, Eliza, take it easy. Take it easy." He got a fresh bowl, poured more cereal, and gave her the carton of milk to pour herself. "Here." She crossed her arms and pouted.
"I don't want it."
"Eliza, you pour that milk this minute." His daughter scrambled up to her chair.
"Okay, Dad."
Sanders sat down, wiped Matt's face, and began to feed his son. The boy immediately stopped crying and swallowed the cereal in big gulps. The poor kid was hungry. Eliza stood on her chair, lifted the milk carton, and splashed it all over the table.
"Uh-oh."
"Never mind." With one hand, he wiped the table with the dish towel, while with the other he continued to feed Matt. Eliza pulled the cereal box right up to her bowl, stared fixedly at the picture of Goofy on the back, and began to eat. Alongside her, Matt ate steadily. For a moment, it was calm in the kitchen. Sanders glanced over his shoulder. Almost 8 o'clock. He should call the office. Susan came in, wearing jeans and a beige sweater. Her face was relaxed.
"I'm sorry I lost it," she said. "Thanks for taking over."
She kissed him on the cheek.
"Are you happy, Mom?"
Eliza said.
"Yes, sweetie."
Susan smiled at her daughter and turned back to Tom.
I'll take over now. You don't want to be late. Isn't today the big day, when they announce your promotion?
I hope so.
Call me as soon as you hear.
I will. Sanders got up, cinched the towel around his waist, and headed upstairs to get dressed. There was always traffic in town before the 8:20 ferry. He would have to hurry to make it. He parked in his spot behind Ricky's shell station and strode quickly down the covered walkway to the ferry. He stepped aboard moments before they pulled up the ramp. Feeling the throb of the engines beneath his feet, he went through the doors onto the main deck.
Hey, Tom!
He looked over his shoulder. Dave Benedict was coming up behind him. Benedict was a lawyer with a firm that handled a lot of high-tech companies.
Missed the 752, huh?
Benedict said.
Yeah, crazy morning. Tell me, I wanted to be in the office an hour ago, but now that school's out, Jenny doesn't know what to do with the kids until camp starts.
Uh-huh.
Madness at my house, Benedict said, shaking his head.
There was a pause. Sanders sensed that he and Benedict had had a similar morning. But the two men did not discuss it further. Sanders often wondered why it was that women discussed the most intimate details of their marriages with their friends, while men maintained a discreet silence with one another.
Anyway, Benedict said, how's Susan?
She's fine. She's great.
Benedict grinned.
So why are you limping?
Company touch football game on Saturday. Got a little out of hand.
That's what you get for playing with children, Benedict said.
Digicom was famous for its young employees.
Hey, Sanders said, I scored.
Is that right?
Damn right. Winning touchdown. Crossed the end zone in glory.
And then I got creamed. At the main deck cafeteria, they stood in line for coffee.
Actually, I would have thought you'd be in bright and early today, Benedict said. Isn't this the big day at Digicom?
Sanders got his coffee and stirred in sweetener.
How's that?
Isn't the merger being announced today?
What merger?
Sanders said blandly. The merger was secret. Only a handful of Digicom executives knew anything about it. He gave Benedict a blank stare.
Come on, Benedict said. I heard it was pretty much wrapped up, and that Bob Garvin was announcing the restructuring today, including a bunch of new promotions.
Benedict sipped his coffee.
Garvin is stepping down, isn't he?
Sanders shrugged.
We'll see.
Of course Benedict was imposing on him, but Susan did a lot of work with attorneys in Benedict's firm. Sanders couldn't afford to be rude. It was one of the new complexities of business relations at a time when everybody had a working spouse. The two men went out on the deck and stood by the port rail, watching the houses of Bainbridge Island slip away. Sanders nodded toward the house on Wing Point, which for years had been Warren Magnuson's summer house when he was senator.
I hear it just sold again, Sanders said.
Oh, yes? Who bought it?
Some California asshole.
Bainbridge slid to the stern. They looked out at the gray water of the Sound. The coffee steamed in the morning sunlight.
So, Benedict said, you think maybe Garvin won't step down?
Nobody knows, Sanders said.
Bob built the company from nothing 15 years ago. When he started, he was selling knockoff modems from Korea. Back when nobody knew what a modem was. Now the company's got 3 buildings downtown and big facilities in California, Texas, Ireland, and Malaysia. He builds fax modems the size of a dime. He markets fax and email software. He's gone into CD-ROMs. And he's developed proprietary algorithms that should make him a leading provider in education markets for the next century.
Bob's come a long way from some guy hustling 300 baud modems. I don't know if he can give it up.
Don't the terms of the merger require it?
Sanders smiled.
If you know about a merger, Dave, you should tell me, he said, because I haven't heard anything.
The truth was that Sanders didn't really know the terms of the impending merger. His work involved the development of CD-ROMs and electronic databases. Although these were areas vital to the future of the company, they were the main reason Conley White was acquiring Digicom. They were essentially technical areas, and Sanders was essentially a technical manager.
he was not informed about decisions at the highest levels. For Sanders, there was some irony in this. In earlier years, when he was based in California, he had been closely involved in management decisions. But since coming to Seattle 8 years ago, he had been more removed from the centers of power. Benedict sipped his coffee.
Well, I hear Bob's definitely stepping down, and he's going to promote a woman as chairman.
Sanders said, "Who told you that?"
"He's already got a woman as CFO, doesn't he?"
"Yes, sure. For a long time now." Stephanie Kaplan was Digicom's chief financial officer, but it seemed unlikely she would ever run the company. Silent and intense, Kaplan was competent but disliked by many in the company. Garvin wasn't especially fond of her.
"Well," Benedict said, "the rumor I've heard is he's going to name a woman to take over within 5 years."
"Does the rumor mention a name?" Benedict shook his head.
"I thought you'd know. I mean, it's your company."
On the deck in the sunshine, he took out his cellular phone and called in. His assistant, Cindy Wolfe, answered.
"Mr. Sanders' office?"
"Hi, it's me."
"Hi, Tom. You on the ferry?"
"Yes, I'll be in a little before 9.
"Okay, I'll tell them."
She paused, and he had the sense that she was choosing her words carefully.
"It's pretty busy this morning. Mr. Garvin was just here, looking for you."
Sanders frowned.
"Looking for me?"
"Yes."
Another pause.
He seemed kind of surprised that you weren't in."
"Did he say what he wanted?"
"No, but he's going into a lot of offices on the floor, one after another, talking to people. Something's up, Tom."
"What?"
"Nobody's telling me anything," she said.
"What about Stephanie?"
"Stephanie called, and I told her you weren't in yet."
"Anything else?"
"Arthur Kahn called from KL to ask if you got his fax."
"I did. I'll call him. Anything else?"
"No, that's about it, Tom."
"Thanks, Cindy."
He pushed the end button to terminate the call. Standing beside him, Benedict pointed to Sanders' phone.
"Those things are amazing. They just get smaller and smaller, don't they? You guys make that one?"
Sanders nodded. "I'd be lost without it, especially these days. Who can remember all the numbers? This is more than a telephone. It's my telephone book. See, look."
He began to demonstrate the features for Benedict.
"It's got a memory for 200 numbers. You store them by the first 3 letters of the name."
Sanders punched in KAH to bring up the international number for Arthur Kahn in Malaysia. He pushed send and heard a long string of electronic beeps. With the country code and area code, it was 13 beeps.
"Jesus," Benedict said. "Where are you calling, Mars?"
"Just about. Malaysia. We've got a factory there." Digicom's Malaysia operation was only a year old, and it was manufacturing the company's new CD-ROM players, units rather like an audio CD player, but intended for computers. It was widely agreed in the business that all information was soon going to be digital, and much of it was going to be stored on these compact disks. Computer programs, databases, even books and magazines, everything was going to be on disk. The reason it hadn't happened already was that CD-ROMs were notoriously slow. Users were obliged to wait in front of blank screens while the drives whirred and clicked, and computer users didn't like waiting. In an industry where speeds reliably doubled every 18 months, CD-ROMs had improved much less in the last 5 years. Digicom's SpeedStar technology addressed that problem with a new generation of drives codenamed Twinkle, for Twinkle Twinkle Little SpeedStar. Twinkle drives were twice as fast as any in the world. Twinkle was packaged as a small standalone multimedia player with its own screen. You could carry it in your hand and use it on a bus or a train. It was going to be revolutionary. But now the Malaysia plant was having trouble manufacturing the new fast drives. Benedict sipped his coffee.
"Is it true you're the only division manager who isn't an engineer?"
Sanders smiled.
"That's right. I'm originally from marketing."
"Isn't that pretty unusual?" Benedict said.
"Not really. In marketing, we used to spend a lot of time figuring out what the features of the new products were, and most of us couldn't talk to the engineers. I could. I don't know why. I don't have a technical background, but I could talk to the guys. I knew just enough so they couldn't bullshit me. So pretty soon, I was the one who talked to the engineers. Then 8 years ago, Garvin asked me if I'd run a division for him. And here I am. The call rang through. Sanders glanced at his watch. It was almost midnight in Kuala Lumpur. He hoped Arthur Khan would still be awake. A moment later, there was a click and a groggy voice said, Hello? Arthur, it's Tom. Arthur Khan gave a gravelly cough. Oh, Tom, good. Another cough. You got my fax? Yes, I got it. Then you know. I don't understand what's going on, Khan said. And I spent all day on the line. I had to, with Jafar gone. Muhammad Jafar was the line foreman of the Malaysia plant, a very capable young man. Jafar is gone? Why? There was a crackle of static. He was cursed. I didn't get that. Jafar was cursed by his cousin, so he left. What? Yeah, if you can believe that. He says his cousin's sister in Johor hired a sorcerer to cast a spell on him, and he ran off to the Orang Asli witch doctors for a counterspell. The Aborigines run a hospital at Kuala Tingit in the jungle about 3 hours outside of KL. It's very famous. A lot of politicians go out there when they get sick. Jafar went out there for a cure. How long will it take? Beats me. The other workers tell me it'll probably be a week. And what's wrong with the line, Arthur? I don't know, Khan said. I'm not sure anything's wrong with the line, but the units coming off are very slow. When we pull units for IP checks, we consistently get seek times above the 100 millisecond specs. We don't know why they're slow, and we don't know why there's a variation. But the engineers here are guessing that there's a compatibility problem with the controller chip that positions the split optics and the CD driver software. You think the controller chips are bad? The controller chips were made in Singapore and trucked across the border to the factory in Malaysia. Don't know. Either they're bad or there's a bug in the driver code. What about the screen flicker? Khan coughed. I think it's a design problem, Tom. We just can't build it. The hinge connectors that carry current to the screen are mounted inside the plastic housing. They're supposed to maintain electrical contact no matter how you move the screen, but the current cuts in and out. You move the hinge, and the screen flashes on and off. Sanders frowned as he listened. This is a pretty standard design, Arthur. Every damn laptop in the world has the same hinge design. It's been that way for the last 10 years. I know it, Khan said, but ours isn't working. It's making me crazy. You better send me some units. I already have, DHL. You'll get them late today, tomorrow at the latest. Okay, Sanders said. He paused. What's your best guess, Arthur? About the run? Well, at the moment we can't make our production quotas, and we're turning out a product 30 to 50% slower than specs. Not good news. This isn't a hot CD player, Tom. It's only incrementally better than what Toshiba and Sony already have on the market. They're making theirs a lot cheaper, so we have major problems. We talking a week, a month, what? A month if it's not a redesign. If it's a redesign, say 4 months. If it's a chip, it could be a year. Sanders sighed. Great. That's the situation. It isn't working, and we don't know why. Sanders said, Who else have you told? Nobody. This one's all yours, my friend. Thanks a lot. Khan coughed. You going to bury this until after the merger, or what? I don't know. I'm not sure I can. Well, I'll be quiet at this end. I can tell you that. Anybody asks me, I don't have a clue. Because I don't. Okay, thanks, Arthur. I'll talk to you later. Sanders hung up. Twinkle definitely presented a political problem for the impending merger with Conley White. Sanders wasn't sure how to handle it, but he would have to deal with it soon enough. The ferry whistle blew, and up ahead he saw the black pilings of Coleman Dock and the skyscrapers of downtown Seattle.
Digicom was located in three different buildings around historic Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle. Pioneer Square was actually shaped like a triangle and had at its center a small park dominated by a wrought iron pergola with antique clocks mounted above. Around Pioneer Square were low-rise red brick buildings built in the early years of the century with sculpted facades and chiseled dates. These buildings now housed trendy architects, graphic design firms, and a cluster of high-tech companies that included Aldus, Advanced Holographics, and Digicom. Originally, Digicom had occupied the Hazard Building on the south side of the square. As the company grew, it expanded into three floors of the adjacent Western Building and later to the Gorham Tower on James Street. But the executive offices were still on the top three floors of the Hazard Building overlooking the square. Sanders' office was on the fourth floor, though he expected later in the week to move up to the fifth. He got to the fourth floor at 9 a.m. and immediately sensed that something was wrong. There was a buzz in the hallways and electric tension in the air. Staff people clustered at the laser printers and whispered at the coffee machines. They turned away or stopped talking when he walked by. He thought, uh-oh. But as a division head, he could hardly stop to ask an assistant what was happening. Sanders walked on, swearing under his breath, angry with himself that he had arrived late on this important day. Through the glass walls of the fourth-floor conference room, he saw Mark Lewin, the 33-year-old head of product design, briefing some of the Conley White people. It made a striking scene. Lewin, young, handsome, and imperious, wearing black jeans and a black Armani T-shirt, pacing back and forth and talking animatedly to the blue-suited Conley White staffers who sat rigidly before the product mock-ups on the table and took notes. When Lewin saw Sanders, he waved and came over to the door of the conference room and stuck his head out.
"Hey, guy," Lewin said.
"Hi, Mark. Listen,
I have just one thing to say to you," Lewin said, interrupting. "Fuck 'em. Fuck Garvin. Fuck Phil. Fuck the merger. Fuck 'em all. This reorg sucks. I'm with you on this one, guy."
"Listen, Mark, can you..."
"I'm in the middle of something here."
Lewin jerked his head toward the Conley people in the room.
"But I wanted you to know how I feel. It's not right what they're doing. We'll talk later, okay? Chin up, guy," Lewin said. "Keep your powder dry."
And he went back into the conference room. The Conley White people were all staring at Sanders through the glass. He turned away and walked quickly toward his office with a sense of deepening unease. Lewin was notorious for his tendency to exaggerate, but even so,
"It's not right what they're doing."
There didn't seem to be much doubt what that meant. Sanders wasn't going to get a promotion. He broke into a light sweat and felt suddenly dizzy as he walked along the corridor. He leaned against the wall for a moment. He wiped his forehead with his hand and blinked his eyes rapidly. He took a deep breath and shook his head to clear it.
No promotion. Christ.
He took another deep breath and walked on. Instead of the promotion he expected, there was apparently going to be some kind of reorganization, and apparently it was related to the merger. The technical divisions had just gone through a major reorganization 9 months earlier, which had revised all the lines of authority, upsetting the hell out of everybody in Seattle. Staff people didn't know who to requisition for laser printer paper or to degauss a monitor. There had been months of uproar. Only in the last few weeks had the tech group settled down into some semblance of good working routine. Now, to reorganize again? It didn't make any sense at all. Yet it was last year's reorganization that placed Sanders in line to assume leadership of the tech divisions now. That reorganization had structured the Advanced Products Group into four subdivisions: Product Design, Programming, Data Telecommunications, and Manufacturing, all under the direction of a division general manager not yet appointed. In recent months, Tom Sanders had informally taken over as DGM, largely because as head of manufacturing, he was the person most concerned with coordinating the work of all the other divisions. But now, with still another reorganization, who knew what might happen? Sanders might be broken back to simply managing Digicom's production lines around the world. Or worse, for weeks, there had been persistent rumors that company headquarters in Cupertino was going to take back all control of manufacturing from Seattle, turning it over to the individual product managers in California. Sanders hadn't paid any attention to those rumors because they didn't make a lot of sense. The product managers had enough to do just pushing the products without also worrying about their manufacture. But now he was obliged to consider the possibility that the rumors were true. Because if they were true, Sanders might be facing more than a demotion. He might be out of a job. Christ, out of a job? He found himself thinking of some of the things Dave Benedict had said to him on the ferry earlier that morning. Benedict chased rumors, and he had seemed to know a lot, maybe even more than he had been saying. "Is it true you're the only division manager who isn't an engineer?" And then pointedly, "Isn't that pretty unusual?" Christ, he thought. He began to sweat again. He forced himself to take another deep breath. He reached the end of the fourth floor corridor and came to his office, expecting to find Stephanie Kaplan, the CFO, waiting there for him. Kaplan could tell him what was going on. But his office was empty. He turned to his assistant, Cindy Wolfe, who was busy at the filing cabinets. "Where's Stephanie?" "She's not coming." "Why not?" "They canceled your 9:30 meeting because of all the personnel changes," Cindy said.
"What changes?" Sanders said. "What's going on?"
"There's been some kind of reorganization," Cindy said. She avoided meeting his eyes and looked down at the call book on her desk. "They just scheduled a private lunch with all the division heads in the main conference room for 12:30 today, and Phil Blackburn is on his way down to talk to you. He should be here any minute. Let's see, what else? DHL is delivering drives from Kuala Lumpur this afternoon. Gary Bosak wants to meet with you at 10:30.
She ran her finger down the call book.
"Don Cherry called twice about the corridor, and you just got a rush call from Eddie in Austin.
Call him back."
Eddie Larson was the production supervisor in the Austin plant, which made cellular telephones. Cindy placed the call. A moment later, he heard the familiar voice with the Texas twang.
"Hey there, Tommy boy."
"Hi, Eddie, what's up?"
"Little problem on the line. You got a minute?"
"Yes, sure."
"Are congratulations on a new job in order?"
"I haven't heard anything yet," Sanders said.
"Uh-huh, but it's going to happen?"
"I haven't heard anything, Eddie."
"Is it true they're going to shut down the Austin plant?"
Sanders was so startled he burst out laughing.
"What?" "Hey, that's what they're saying down here, Tommy boy. Conley White is going to buy the company and then shut us down."
"Hell," Sanders said. "Nobody's buying anything, and nobody's selling anything, Eddie. The Austin line is an industry standard, and it's very profitable."
He paused.
"You'd tell me if you knew, wouldn't you, Tommy boy?"
"Yes, I would," Sanders said. "But it's just a rumor, Eddie, so forget it. Now, what's the line problem?"
"Diddly stuff. The women on the production line are demanding that we clean out the pinups in the men's locker room. They say it's offensive to them." "You ask me, I think it's bull," Larson said, "because women never go into the men's locker room."
"Then how do they know about the pinups?"
"The night cleanup crews have women on them, so now the women working the line want the pinups removed."
Sanders sighed.
"We don't need any complaints about being unresponsive on sex issues. Get the pinups out."
"Even if the women have pinups in their locker room?"
"Just do it, Eddie."
"You ask me, it's caving into a lot of feminist bullshit."
There was a knock on the door. Sanders looked up and saw Phil Blackburn, the company lawyer, standing there.
"Eddie, I have to go."
"Okay," Eddie said, "but I'm telling you..."
"Eddie, I'm sorry. I have to go. Call me if anything changes."
Sanders hung up the phone and Blackburn came into the room. Sanders' first impression was that the lawyer was smiling too broadly, behaving too cheerfully. It was a bad sign. Philip Blackburn, the chief legal counsel for Digicom, was a slender man of 46 wearing a dark green Hugo Boss suit. Like Sanders, Blackburn had been with Digicom for over a decade, which meant that he was one of the old guys, one of those who had gotten in at the beginning. When Sanders first met him, Blackburn was a brash, bearded young civil rights lawyer from Berkeley. But Blackburn had long since abandoned protest for profits, which he pursued with single-minded intensity.
while carefully emphasizing the new corporate issues of diversity and equal opportunity. Blackburn's embrace of the latest fashions in clothing and correctness made P.C. Phil a figure of fun in some quarters of the company. As one executive put it, "Phil's finger is chapped from wetting it and holding it to the wind." He was the first with Birkenstocks, the first with bell-bottoms, the first with sideburns off, and the first with diversity. Many of the jokes focused on his mannerisms. Fussy, preoccupied with appearances, Blackburn was always running his hands over himself, touching his hair, his face, his suit, seeming to caress himself to smooth out the wrinkles in his suit. This, combined with his unfortunate tendency to rub, touch, and pick his nose, was the source of much humor. But it was humor with an edge. Blackburn was mistrusted as a moralistic hatchet man. Blackburn could be charismatic in his speeches, and in private could convey a convincing impression of intellectual honesty for short periods. But within the company, he was seen for what he was, a gun for hire, a man with no convictions of his own, and hence the perfect person to be Garvin's executioner. In earlier years, Sanders and Blackburn had been close friends. Not only had they grown up with the company, but their lives were intertwined personally as well. When Blackburn went through his bitter divorce in 1982, he lived for a while in Sanders' bachelor apartment in Sunnyvale. A few years later, Blackburn had been best man at Sanders' own wedding to a young Seattle attorney, Susan Handler. But when Blackburn remarried in 1989, Sanders was not invited to the wedding, for by then, the relationship had become strained. Some in the company saw it as inevitable. Blackburn was part of the inner power circle in Cupertino, to which Sanders, based in Seattle, no longer belonged. In addition, the two men had had sharp disputes about setting up the production lines in Ireland and Malaysia. Sanders felt that Blackburn ignored the inevitable realities of production in foreign countries. Typical was Blackburn's demand that half the workers on the new line in Kuala Lumpur should be women, and that they should be intermingled with the men. The Malay managers wanted the women segregated, allowed to work only on certain parts of the line, away from the men. Phil strenuously objected. Sanders kept telling him, "It's a Muslim country, Phil." "I don't give a damn," Phil said. "Digicom stands for equality." "Phil, it's their country. They're Muslim." "So what? It's our factory." Their disagreements went on and on. The Malaysian government didn't want local Chinese hired as supervisors, although they were the best qualified. It was the policy of the Malaysian government to train Malays for supervisory jobs. Sanders disagreed with this blatantly discriminatory policy because he wanted the best supervisors he could get for the plant. But Phil, an outspoken opponent of discrimination in America, immediately acquiesced to the Malay government's discriminatory policy, saying that Digicom should embrace a true multicultural perspective. At the last minute, Sanders had had to fly to Kuala Lumpur and meet with the sultans of Selangor and Pahang to agree to their demands. Phil then announced that Sanders had toadied up to the extremists. It was just one of the many controversies that surrounded Sanders' handling of the new Malaysia factory. Now, Sanders and Blackburn greeted each other with the wariness of former friends who had long since ceased to be anything but superficially cordial. Sanders shook Blackburn's hand as the company lawyer stepped into the office. "What's going on, Phil?"
"Big day,"
Blackburn said, slipping into the chair facing Sanders' desk.
"Lot of surprises. I don't know what you've heard."
"I've heard Garvin has made a decision about the restructuring."
"Yes, he has. Several decisions."
There was a pause. Blackburn shifted in his chair and looked at his hands.
"I know that Bob wanted to fill you in himself about all this. He came by earlier this morning to talk to everyone in the division."
"I wasn't here."
"Uh-huh. We were all kind of surprised that you were late today."
Sanders let that pass without comment. He stared at Blackburn, waiting.
"Anyway, Tom," Blackburn said, "the bottom line is this. As part of the overall merger, Bob has decided to go outside the Advanced Products Group for leadership of the division."
So there it was, finally out in the open. Sanders took a deep breath, felt the bands of tightness in his chest. His whole body was tense, but he tried not to show it.
I know this is something of a shock, Blackburn said.
Well, Sanders shrugged. I've heard rumors. Even as he spoke, his mind was racing ahead. It was clear now that there would not be a promotion, there would not be a raise, he would not have a new opportunity to...
Yes.
Well, Blackburn said, clearing his throat, Bob has decided that Meredith Johnson is going to head up the division.
Sanders frowned. Meredith Johnson?
Right. She's in the Cupertino office. I think you know her.
Yes, I do, but...
Sanders shook his head. It didn't make any sense.
Meredith's from sales. Her background is in sales.
Originally, yes, but as you know, Meredith's been in operations the last couple of years.
Even so, Phil, the APG is a technical division.
You're not technical. You've done just fine.
But I've been involved in this for years, when I was in marketing.
Look, the APG is basically programming teams and hardware fabrication lines. How can she run it?
Bob doesn't expect her to run it directly. She'll oversee the APG division managers, who will report to her. Meredith's official title will be Vice President for Advanced Operations and Planning. Under the new structure, that will include the entire APG division, the marketing division, and the telecom division.
Jesus, Sanders said, sitting back in his chair. That's pretty much everything.
Blackburn nodded slowly.
Sanders paused, thinking it over.
It sounds, he said finally, like Meredith Johnson's going to be running this company.
I wouldn't go that far, Blackburn said.
She won't have direct control over sales or finance or distribution in this new scheme. But I think there is no question Bob has placed her in direct line for succession when he steps down as CEO sometime in the next 2 years.
Blackburn shifted in his chair.
But that's the future. For the present...
Just a minute. She'll have 4 APG division managers reporting to her, Sanders said.
Yes.
And who are those managers going to be? Has that been decided?
Well...
Phil coughed. He ran his hands over his chest and plucked at the handkerchief in his breast pocket.
Of course, the actual decision to name the division managers will be Meredith's.
Meaning I might not have a job.
Oh, hell, Tom, Blackburn said. Nothing of the sort. Bob wants everyone in the divisions to stay, including you. He'd hate very much to lose you.
But it's Meredith Johnson's decision whether I keep my job.
Technically, Blackburn said, spreading his hands, it has to be. But I think it's pretty much pro forma.
Sanders did not see it that way at all. Garvin could easily have named all the division managers at the same time he named Meredith Johnson to run the APG. If Garvin decided to turn the company over to some woman from sales, that was certainly his choice. But Garvin could still make sure he kept his division heads in place, the heads who had served him and the company so well.
Jesus, Sanders said. I've been with this company 12 years.
And I expect you will be with us many more, Blackburn said smoothly.
Look, it's in everybody's interest to keep the teams in place, because, as I said, she can't run them directly.
Uh-huh. Blackburn shot his cuffs and ran his hand through his hair.
Listen, Tom, I know you're disappointed that this appointment didn't come to you, but let's not make too much of Meredith appointing the division heads. Realistically speaking, she isn't going to make any changes. Your situation is secure.
He paused.
You know the way Meredith is, Tom.
I used to, Sanders said, nodding. Hell, I lived with her for a while, but I haven't seen her in years.
Blackburn looked surprised. You two haven't kept contact?
Not really, no. By the time Meredith joined the company, I was up here in Seattle, and she was based in Cupertino. I ran into her once on a trip down there. Said hello. That's about it.
Then you only know her from the old days, Blackburn said, as if it all suddenly made sense. From 6 or 7 years ago.
It's longer than that, Sanders said. I've been in Seattle 8 years, so it must be...
Sanders thought back.
When I was going out with her, she worked for Novell in Mountain View. selling Ethernet cards to small businesses for local area networks.
When was that?
Although he remembered the relationship with Meredith Johnson vividly, Sanders was hazy about exactly when it had occurred. He tried to recall some memorable event, a birthday, a promotion, an apartment move, that would mark the date. Finally, he remembered watching election returns with her on television, balloons rising up toward the ceiling, people cheering. She was drinking beer. That had been early in their relationship.
Jesus, Phil. It must be almost 10 years ago.
That long, Blackburn said. When Sanders first met Meredith Johnson, she was one of the thousands of pretty saleswomen working in San Jose, young women in their 20s, not long out of college, who started out doing the product demos on the computer while a senior man stood beside her and did all the talking to the customer. Eventually, a lot of those women learned enough to do the selling themselves. At the time Sanders first knew Meredith, she had acquired enough jargon to rattle on about token rings and 10-base T-hubs. She didn't really have any deep knowledge, but she didn't need to. She was good-looking, sexy, and smart, and she had a kind of uncanny self-possession that carried her through awkward moments. Sanders had admired her back in those days, but he never imagined that she had the ability to hold a major corporate position. Blackburn shrugged.
A lot's happened in 10 years, Tom, he said. Meredith isn't just a sales exec. She went back to school, got an MBA. She worked at Symantec, then Conrad, and then she came to work with us. The last couple of years, she's been working very closely with Garvin, sort of his protege. He's been pleased with her work on a number of assignments.
Sanders shook his head. And now she's my boss.
Is that a problem for you?
No, it just seems funny. An old girlfriend as my boss.
The worm turns, Blackburn said.
He was smiling, but Sanders sensed he was watching him closely.
You seem a little uneasy about this, Tom.
It takes some getting used to.
Is there a problem, reporting to a woman?
Not at all. I worked for Eileen when she was head of HRI, and we got along great. It's not that. It's just funny to think of Meredith Johnson as my boss.
She's an impressive and accomplished manager, Phil said.
He stood up, smoothed his tie.
I think when you've had an opportunity to become reacquainted, you'll be very impressed. Give her a chance, Tom.
Of course, Sanders said.
I'm sure everything will work out, and keep your eye on the future. After all, you should be rich in a year or so.
Does that mean we're still spinning off the APG division?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It was a much-discussed part of the merger plan that after Conley White bought Digicom, it would spin off the Advanced Products division and take it public as a separate company. That would mean enormous profits for everyone in the division, because everyone would have the chance to buy cheap options before the stock was publicly sold.
We're working out the final details now, Blackburn said. But I expect that division managers like yourself will start with 20,000 shares vested and an initial option of 50,000 shares at 25 cents a share, with the right to purchase another 50,000 shares each year for the next 5 years.
And the spinoff will go forward, even with Meredith running the divisions?
Trust me, the spinoff will happen within 18 months. It's a formal part of the merger plan.
There's no chance that she may decide to change her mind?
Not at all, Tom, Blackburn smiled. I'll tell you a little secret. Originally, this spinoff was Meredith's idea.
Blackburn left Sanders' office and went down the hall to an empty office and called Garvin. He heard the familiar sharp bark.
Garvin here.
I talked to Tom Sanders.
And?
I'd say he took it well. He was disappointed, of course. I think he'd already heard a rumor, but he took it well.
Garvin said, And the new structure? How did he respond?
He's concerned, Blackburn said. He expressed reservations.
Why?
He doesn't feel she has the technical expertise to run the division.
Gavin snorted.
Technical expertise? That's the last goddamn thing I care about. Technical expertise is not an issue here.
Of course not, but I think there was some uneasiness on the personal level. You know, they once had a relationship.
Yes, Garvin said. I know that. Have they talked?
He says not for several years.
Bad blood?
There didn't seem to be.
Then what's he concerned about?
I think he's just getting used to the idea.
He'll come around.
I think so.
Tell me if you hear otherwise, Garvin said, and hung up.
Alone in the office, Blackburn frowned. The conversation with Sanders left him vaguely uneasy. It had seemed to go well enough, and yet... Sanders, he felt sure, was not going to take this reorganization lying down. Sanders was popular in the Seattle division, and he could easily cause trouble. Sanders was too independent. He was not a team player, and the company needed team players now. The more Blackburn thought about it, the more certain he was that Sanders was going to be a problem. Tom Sanders sat at his desk, staring forward, lost in thought. He was trying to put together his memory of a pretty young saleswoman in Silicon Valley with this new image of a corporate officer running company divisions, executing the complex groundwork required to take a division public. But his thoughts kept being interrupted by random images from the past. Meredith smiling, wearing one of his shirts, naked beneath it, an opened suitcase on the bed, white stockings and white garter belt, a bowl of popcorn on the blue couch in the living room, the television with the sound turned off. And for some reason, the image of a flower, a purple iris, in stained glass. It was one of those hackneyed Northern California hippie images. Sanders knew where it came from. It was the glass on the front door to the apartment where he had lived, back in Sunnyvale. Back in the days when he had known Meredith. He wasn't sure why he should keep thinking of it now, and he... Tom? He glanced up. Cindy was standing in the doorway, looking concerned. Tom, do you want coffee?
No, thanks.
Don Cherry called again while you were with Phil. He wants you to come and look at the corridor.
They having problems?
I don't know. He sounded excited. You want to call him back?
Not right now. I'll go down and see him in a minute. She lingered at the door.
You want a bagel? Have you had breakfast?
I'm fine.
Sure?
I'm fine, Cindy. Really.
She went away.
He turned to look at his monitor and saw that the icon for his email was blinking. But he was thinking again about Meredith Johnson. Sanders had more or less lived with her for about 6 months. It had been quite an intense relationship for a while, and yet, although he kept having isolated, vivid images, he realized that in general his memories from that time were surprisingly vague. Had he really lived with Meredith for 6 months? When exactly had they first met? And when had they broken up? Sanders was surprised at how difficult it was for him to fix the chronology in his mind. Hoping for clarity, he considered other aspects of his life. What had been his position at Digicom in those days? Was he still working in marketing, or had he already moved to the technical divisions? He wasn't sure now. He would have to look it up in the files. He thought about Blackburn. Blackburn had left his wife and moved in with Sanders around the time Sanders was involved with Meredith. Or was it afterward, when things had gone bad? Maybe Phil had moved into his apartment around the time he was breaking up with Meredith. Sanders wasn't sure. As he considered it, he realized he wasn't sure about anything from that time. These events had all happened a decade ago, in another city, at another period in his life, and his memories were in disarray. Again, he was surprised at how confused he was. He pushed the intercom. Cindy, I've got a question for you.
Sure, Tom.
This is the third week of June. What were you doing the third week of June 10 years ago? She didn't even hesitate.
That's easy, graduating from college.
Of course that would be true.
Okay, he said, then how about June 9 years ago?
9 years ago?
Her voice sounded suddenly cautious, less certain.
Gee, let's see, June 9 years ago? June. I think I was with my boyfriend in Europe.
Not your present boyfriend?
No, this guy was a real jerk.
Sanders said, how long did that last?
We were there for a month. I mean the relationship.
With him?
Oh, let's see, we broke up. Oh, it must have been
December. I think it was December, or maybe January, after the holidays. Why?
Just trying to figure something out, Sanders said.
Already he was relieved to hear the uncertain tone of her voice as she tried to piece together the past.
By the way, how far back do we have office records, correspondence, and call books?
I'd have to check. I know I have about 3 years.
And what about earlier?
Earlier? How much earlier?
10 years ago, he said.
Gee, that'd be when you were in Cupertino. Do they have that stuff in storage down there? Did they put it on fiche, or was it just thrown out?
I don't know.
You want me to check?
Not now, he said, and clicked off. He didn't want her making any inquiries in Cupertino now.
Not right now.
Sanders rubbed his eyes with his fingertips, his thoughts drifting back over time. Again, he saw the stained glass flower. It was oversized, bright, banal. Sanders had always been embarrassed by the banality of it. In those days, he had lived in one of the apartment complexes on Murano Drive. 20 units clustered around a chilly little swimming pool. Everybody in the building worked for a high-tech company. Nobody ever went in the pool, and Sanders wasn't around much. Those were the days when he flew with Garvin to Korea twice a month. The days when they all flew coach. They couldn't even afford business class. And he remembered how he would come home, exhausted from the long flight, and the first thing he would see when he got to his apartment was that damned stained glass flower on the door. Aunt Meredith, in those days, was partial to white stockings, a white garter belt, little white flowers on the snaps with...
Tom?
He looked up. Cindy was at the doorway. She said,
If you want to see Don Cherry, you'd better go now because you have a 10:30 with Gary Bosak.
He felt as if she was treating him like an invalid. Cindy, I'm fine.
I know. Just a reminder.
Okay, I'll go now. As he hurried down the stairs to the third floor, he felt relieved at the distraction. Cindy was right to get him out of the office, and he was curious to see what Cherry's team had done with the corridor. The corridor was what everyone at Digicom called VIE, the Virtual Information Environment. VIE was the companion piece to Twinkle, the second major element in the emerging future of digital information as envisioned by Digicom. In the future, information was going to be stored on disks or made available in large databases that users would dial into over telephone lines. At the moment, users saw information displayed on flat screens, either televisions or computer screens. That had been the traditional way of handling information for the last 30 years. But soon, there would be new ways to present information. The most radical and the most exciting was virtual environments. Users wore special glasses to see computer-generated three-dimensional environments which allowed them to feel as though they were literally moving through another world. Dozens of high-tech companies were racing to develop virtual environments. It was exciting, but very difficult, technology. At Digicom, VIE was one of Garvin's pet projects. He had thrown a lot of money at it. He had had Don Cherry's programmers working on it around the clock for 2 years. And so far, it had been nothing but trouble. The sign on the door said VIE, and underneath, When Reality Is Not Enough. Sanders inserted his card in the slot, and the door clicked open. He passed through an ante-room, hearing a half-dozen voices shouting from the main equipment room beyond. Even in the ante-room, he noticed a distinctly nauseating odor in the air. Entering the main room, he came upon a scene of utter chaos. The windows were thrown wide. There was the astringent smell of cleaning fluid. Most of the programmers were on the floor, working with disassembled equipment. The VIE units lay scattered in pieces amid a tangle of multicolored cables. Even the black circular walker pads had been taken apart, the rubber bearings being cleaned one by one. Still more wires descended from the ceiling to the laser scanners, which were broken open, their circuit boards exposed. Everyone seemed to be talking at once. And in the center of the room, looking like a teenage Buddha in an electric blue T-shirt that said, Reality Sucks, was Don Cherry, the head of programming. Cherry was 22 years old, widely acknowledged to be indispensable, and famous for his impertinence. When he saw Sanders, he shouted, Out! Out! Damned management, out! Why? Sanders said. I thought you wanted to see me.
Too late. You had your chance, Cherry said. Now it's over.
For a moment, Sanders thought Cherry was referring to the promotion he hadn't gotten. But Cherry was the most apolitical of the Digicom division heads, and he was grinning cheerfully as he walked toward Sanders, stepping over his prostrate programmers.
Sorry, Tom, you're too late. We're fine-tuning now.
Fine-tuning? It looks like ground zero here. And what's that terrible smell?
I know. Cherry threw up his hands. I ask the boys to wash every day, but what can I say? They're programmers, no better than dogs.
Cindy said you called me several times.
I did, Cherry said. We had the corridor up and running, and I wanted you to see it. But maybe it's just as well you didn't.
Sanders looked at the complex equipment scattered all around him.
You had it up? That was then. This is now. Now we're fine-tuning.
Cherry nodded to the programmers on the floor, working on the walker pads.
We finally got the bug out of the main loop, last night at midnight. The refresh rate doubled. The system really rips now. So we have to adjust the walkers and the servos to update responsiveness. It's a mechanical problem, he said disdainfully. But we'll take care of it anyway.
The programmers were always annoyed when they had to deal with mechanical problems. Living almost entirely in an abstract world of computer code, they felt that physical machinery was beneath them. Sanders said, "What is the problem exactly?"
"Well, look," Cherry said, "here's our latest implementation. The user wears this headset," he said, pointing to what looked like thick silver sunglasses, "and gets on the walker pad here."
The walker pad was one of Cherry's innovations. The size of a small round trampoline, its surface was composed of tightly packed rubber balls. It functioned like a multi-directional treadmill. Walking on the balls, users could move in any direction.
"Once he's on the walker," Cherry said, "the user dials into a database. Then the computer, over there," Cherry pointed to a stack of boxes in the corner, "takes the information coming from the database and constructs a virtual environment which is projected inside the headset. When the user walks on the pad, the projection changes, so you feel like you're walking down a corridor lined with drawers of data on all sides. The user can stop anywhere, open any file drawer with his hand, and thumb through data. Completely realistic simulation."
"How many users?"
"At the moment, the system can handle 5 at one time."
"And the corridor looks like what?" Sanders said.
"Wireframe?"
In the earlier versions, the corridor was outlined in skeletal black and white outlines. Fewer lines made it faster for the computer to draw.
"Wireframe?" Cherry sniffed. "Please! We dumped that 2 weeks ago. Now we are talking 3D surfaces fully modeled in 24-bit color, with anti-alias texture maps. We're rendering true curved surfaces, no polygons. Looks completely real."
"And what are the laser scanners for? I thought you did position by infrared." The headsets had infrared sensors mounted above them so that the system could detect where the user was looking and adjust the projected image inside the headset to match the direction of looking.
"We still do," Cherry said. "The scanners are for body representation."
"Body representation?"
"Yeah. Now, if you're walking down the corridor with somebody else, you can turn and look at them, and you'll see them. Because the scanners are capturing a three-dimensional texture map in real time. They read body and expression, and draw the virtual face of the virtual person standing beside you in the virtual room. You can't see the person's eyes, of course, because they're hidden by the headset they're wearing. But the system generates a face from the stored texture map. Pretty slick, huh?"
"You mean you can see other users?"
"That's right. See their faces, see their expressions. And that's not all. If other users in the system aren't wearing a headset, you can still see them, too. The program identifies other users, pulls their photo out of the personnel file, and pastes it onto a virtual body image. A little kludgy, but not bad."
Cherry waved his hand in the air.
"And that's not all. We've also built in virtual help."
"Virtual help?"
"Sure, users always need online help. So we've made an angel to help you. Floats alongside you, answers your questions."
Cherry was grinning.
We thought of making it a blue fairy, but we didn't want to offend anybody.
Sanders stared thoughtfully at the room. Cherry was telling him about his successes, but something else was happening here. It was impossible to miss the tension, the frantic energy of the people as they worked.
"Hey, Don," one of the programmers shouted, "what's the Z-count supposed to be?"
"Over 5," Cherry said.
"I got it to 4-3.
4-3 sucks. Get it above 5 or you're fired."
He turned to Sanders.
"You've got to encourage the troops."
Sanders looked at Cherry.
"All right," he said finally. "Now what's the real problem?"
Cherry shrugged.
"Nothing. I told you. Fine-tuning."
"Don."
Cherry sighed.
"Well, when we jumped the refresh rate, we trashed the builder module. You see, the room is being built in real time by the box. With a faster refresh off the sensors, we have to build objects much faster. Otherwise, the room seems to lag behind you. You feel like you're drunk. You move your head, and the room swooshes behind you, catching up."
"And?"
"And it makes the users throw up."
Sanders sighed.
"Great."
"We had to take the walker pads apart because Teddy barfed all over everything."
"Great, Don."
"What's the matter? It's no big deal. It cleans up."
He shook his head.
"Although I do wish Teddy hadn't eaten huevos rancheros for breakfast. That was unfortunate. Little bits of tortilla everywhere in the bearings."
"You know we have a demo tomorrow for the CW people."
"No problem. We'll be ready."
"Don, I can't have their top executives throwing up."
"Trust me," Cherry said. "We'll be ready. They're going to love it. Whatever problems this company has, the corridor is not one of them."
"That's a promise?"
"That," Cherry said, "is a guarantee."
Sanders was back in his office by 10:20 and was seated at his desk when Gary Bosack came in. Bosack was a tall man in his 20s, wearing jeans, running shoes, and a Terminator T-shirt. He carried a large fold-over leather briefcase, the kind that trial attorneys used.
"You look pale," Bosack said. "But everybody in the building is pale today. It's tense as hell around here, you know that?"
"I've noticed."
"Yeah, I bet. Okay to start?"
"Sure."
"Cindy, Mr. Sanders is going to be unavailable for a few minutes."
Bosack closed the office door and locked it. Whistling cheerfully, he unplugged Sanders' desk phone and the phone beside the couch in the corner. From there, he went to the window and closed the blinds. There was a small television in the corner. He turned it on. He snapped the latches on his briefcase, took out a small plastic box, and flipped the switch on the side. The box began to blink and emitted a low white noise hiss. Bosack set it in the middle of Sanders' desk. Bosack never gave information until the white noise scrambler was in place, since most of what he had to say implied illegal behavior.
"I have good news for you," Bosack said. "Your boy is clean."
He pulled out a manila file, opened it up, and started handing over pages.
"Peter John Neely, 23, Digicom employee for 16 months, now working as a programmer in APG. Okay, here we go. His high school and college transcripts. Employment file from Data General, his last employer. All in order. Now, the recent stuff. Credit rating from TRW. Phone bills from his apartment. Phone bills for his cellular line. Bank statement. Savings account. Last 2 1040s. 12 months of credit card charges, Visa and Master. Travel records. Email messages inside the company and off the internet. Parking tickets. And this is the clincher. Ramada Inn in Sunnyvale. Last 3 visits. His phone charges there. The numbers he called. Last 3 car rentals with mileage. Rental car cellular phone. The numbers called. That's everything."
"And?"
"I ran down the numbers he called. Here's the breakdown. A lot of calls to Seattle Silicon. But Neely's seeing a girl there. She's a secretary, works in sales, no conflict. He also calls his brother, a programmer at Boeing, does parallel processing stuff for wing design. No conflict. His other calls are to suppliers and code vendors, and they're all appropriate. No calls after hours, no calls to pay phones, no overseas calls. No suspicious pattern in the calls.
No unexplained bank transfers, no sudden new purchases. No reason to think he's looking for a move. I'd say he's not talking to anybody you care about.
Good, Sanders said. He glanced down at the sheets of paper and paused.
Gary, some of this stuff is from our company. Some of these reports.
Yeah. So?
How'd you get them?
Bosak grinned.
Hey, you don't ask and I don't tell you.
How'd you get the data general file?
Bosak shook his head.
Isn't this why you pay me?
Yes, it is, but...
Hey, you wanted a check on an employee. You got it. Your kid's clean. He's working only for you.
Anything else you want to know about him?
No. Sanders shook his head.
Great. I've got to get some sleep.
Bosak collected all the files and placed them back in his folder.
By the way, you're going to get a call from my parole officer.
Uh-huh.
Can I count on you?
Sure, Gary.
I told him I was doing consulting for you on telecommunication security.
And so you are. Bosak switched off the blinking box, put it in his briefcase, and reconnected the telephones.
Always a pleasure. Do I leave the bill with you or Cindy?
I'll take it. See you, Gary.
Hey, anytime. You need more, you know where I am.
Sanders glanced at the bill from N.E. Professional Services Incorporated of Bellevue, Washington. The name was Bosak's private joke. The letters N.E. stood for Necessary Evil. Ordinarily, high-tech companies employed retired police officers and private investigators to do background checks, but occasionally they used hackers like Gary Bosak, who could gain access to electronic data banks to get information on suspect employees. The advantage of using Bosak was that he could work quickly, often making a report in a matter of hours or overnight. Bosak's methods were, of course, illegal. Simply by hiring him, Sanders himself had broken a half-dozen laws. But background checks on employees were accepted as standard practice in high-tech firms, where a single document or product development plan might be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to competitors. And in the case of Pete Neely, a check was particularly crucial. Neely was developing hot new compression algorithms to pack and unpack video images onto CD-ROM laser discs. His work was vital to the new Twinkle technology. High-speed digital images coming off the disc were going to transform a sluggish technology and produce a revolution in education. But if Twinkle's algorithms became available to a competitor, then Digicom's advantage would be greatly reduced, and that meant... The intercom buzzed.
Tom, Cindy said, it's 11 o'clock. Time for the APG meeting. You want the agenda on your way down?
Not today, he said. I think I know what we'll be talking about.
In the third floor conference room, the Advanced Products Group was already meeting. This was a weekly meeting in which the division heads discussed problems and brought everyone up to date. It was a meeting that Sanders ordinarily led. Around the table were Don Cherry, the chief of programming, Mark Lewin, the temperamental head of product design, all in black Armani, and Mary Ann Hunter, the head of data telecommunications. Petite and intense, Hunter was dressed in a sweatshirt, shorts, and Nike running tights. She never ate lunch, but ordinarily went on a 5-mile run after each meeting. Lewin was in the middle of one of his storming rages.
It's insulting to everybody in the division. I have no idea why she got this position. I don't know what her qualifications could be for a job like this, and...
Lewin broke off as Sanders came into the room. There was an awkward moment. Everyone was silent, glancing at him, then looking away.
I had a feeling, Sanders said, smiling, you'd be talking about this.
The room remained silent.
Come on, he said as he slipped into a chair. It's not a funeral.
Mark Lewin cleared his throat.
I'm sorry, Tom. I think it's an outrage.
Mary Ann Hunter said,
Everybody knows it should have been you.
Lewin said,
It's a shock to all of us, Tom.
Yeah, Cherry said, grinning. We've been trying like hell to get you sacked, but we never really thought it would work.
I appreciate all this, Sanders said, but it's Garvin's company, and he can do what he wants with it. He's been right more often than not, and I'm a big boy. Nobody ever promised me anything.
Lewin said,
"You're really okay with this?"
"Believe me, I'm fine." "You talked with Garvin?" "I talked with Phil." Lewin shook his head. "That sanctimonious asshole."
"Listen," Cherry said, "did Phil say anything about the spinoff?"
"Yes," Sanders said. "The spinoff is still happening. 18 months after the merger, they'll structure the IPO and take the division public." There were little shrugs around the table. Sanders could see they were relieved. Going public meant a lot of money to all the people sitting in the room.
"And what did Phil say about Ms. Johnson?"
"Not much, just that she's Garvin's choice to head up the technical side." At that moment, Stephanie Kaplan, Digicom's chief financial officer, came into the room. A tall woman with prematurely gray hair and a notably silent manner, she was known as Stephanie Stealth, or the Stealth Bomber, the latter a reference to her habit of quietly killing projects she did not consider profitable enough. Kaplan was based in Cupertino, but she generally sat in once a month on the Seattle division meetings. Lately, she had been up more often. Lewin said,
"We're trying to cheer up Tom, Stephanie."
Kaplan took a seat and gave Sanders a sympathetic smile. She didn't speak. Lewin said,
"Did you know this Meredith Johnson appointment was coming?"
"No," Kaplan said. "It was a surprise to everybody. And not everybody's happy about it."
Then, as if she had said too much, she opened her briefcase and busied herself with her notes. As usual, she slid into the background. The others quickly ignored her.
"Well," Cherry said, "I hear Garvin's got a real thing for her. Johnson's only been with the company 4 years, and she hasn't been especially outstanding. But Garvin took her under his wing. 2 years ago, he began moving her up, fast. For some reason, he just thinks Meredith Johnson is great."
Lewin said,
"Is Garvin fucking her?"
"No, he just likes her."
"She must be fucking somebody."
"Wait a minute," Marianne Hunter said, sitting up.
"What's this? If Garvin brought in some guy from Microsoft to run this division, nobody'd say he must be fucking somebody."
Cherry laughed.
"It'd depend on who he was. I'm serious. Why is it when a woman gets a promotion, she must be fucking somebody?"
Lewin said,
"Look, if they brought in Ellen Howard from Microsoft, we wouldn't be having this conversation because we all know Ellen's very competent. We wouldn't like it, but we'd accept it. But nobody even knows Meredith Johnson. I mean, does anybody here know her?"
"Actually," Sanders said, "I know her." There was silence.
"I used to go out with her."
Cherry laughed.
"So you're the one she's fucking."
Sanders shook his head. "It was years ago." Hunter said,
"What's she like?"
"Yeah," Cherry said, grinning lasciviously.
"What's she like?"
"Shut up, Don."
"Lighten up, Marianne."
"She worked for Novell when I knew her," Sanders said. "She was about 25, smart and ambitious."
"Smart and ambitious," Lewin said. "That's fine. The world's full of smart and ambitious. The question is, can she run a technical division? Or have we got another screamer freeling on our hands?"
2 years earlier, Garvin had put a sales manager named Howard Freeling in charge of the division. The idea was to bring product development in contact with customers at an earlier point to develop new products more in line with the emerging market. Freeling instituted focus groups, and they all spent a lot of time watching potential customers play with new products behind one-way glass. But Freeling was completely unfamiliar with technical issues. So when confronted with a problem, he screamed. He was like a tourist in a foreign country who didn't speak the language and thought he could make the locals understand by shouting at them. Freeling's tenure at APG was a disaster. The programmers loathed him. The designers rebelled at his idea for neon-colored product boxes. The manufacturing glitches at factories in Ireland and Texas didn't get solved. Finally, when the production line in Cork went down for 11 days, Freeling flew over and screamed. The Irish managers all quit, and Garvin fired him.
"So, is that what we have? Another screamer?"
Stephanie Kaplan cleared her throat.
"I think Garvin learned his lesson.
he wouldn't make the same mistake twice.
So you think Meredith Johnson is up to the job?
I couldn't say, Kaplan replied, speaking very deliberately.
Not much of an endorsement, Lewin said.
But I think she'll be better than Freeling, Kaplan said. Lewin snorted.
This is the Taller Than Mickey Rooney Award. You can still be very short and win.
No, Kaplan said. I think she'll be better.
Cherry said,
better looking, at least, from what I hear.
Sexist, Marianne Hunter said.
What? I can't say she's good-looking?
We're talking about her competence, not her appearance.
Wait a minute, Cherry said. Coming over here to this meeting, I passed the women at the espresso bar, and what are they talking about? Whether Richard Gere has better buns than Mel Gibson. They're talking about the crack in the ass, lift and separate, all that stuff. I don't see why they can talk about...
We're drifting afield, Sanders said.
It doesn't matter what you guys say, Hunter said. The fact is, this company is dominated by males. There are almost no women except Stephanie in high executive positions. I think it's great that Bob has appointed a woman to run this division, and I, for one, think we should support her.
She looked at Sanders.
We all love you, Tom, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, we all love you, Cherry said. At least we did until we got our cute new boss.
Lewin said, I'll support Johnson, if she's any good.
No, you won't, Hunter said. You'll sabotage her. You'll find a reason to get rid of her.
Wait a minute.
No, what is this conversation really about? It's about the fact that you're all pissed off because now you have to report to a woman.
Marianne.
I mean it.
Lewin said,
I think Tom's pissed off because he didn't get the job.
I'm not pissed off, Sanders said.
Well, I'm pissed off, Cherry said, because Meredith used to be Tom's girlfriend, so now he has a special in with the new boss.
Maybe. Sanders frowned.
Lewin said, on the other hand, maybe she hates you. All my old girlfriends hate me.
With good reason, I hear, Cherry said, laughing.
Sanders said, let's get back to the agenda, shall we?
What agenda?
Twinkle. There were groans around the table.
Not again.
Goddamn, Twinkle!
How bad is it? Cherry said.
They still can't get the seek times down, and they can't solve the hinge problems. The line's running at 29%.
Well, there's no seeing that.
Oh, shit. They better send us some units. We should have them today.
Okay, table it till then.
It's okay with me. Sanders looked around the table. Anybody else have a problem? Marianne?
No, we're fine. We still expect prototype card phones off our test line within 2 months.
The new generation of cellular telephones were not much larger than a credit card. They folded open for use.
How's the weight?
The weight's now 4 ounces, which is not great, but okay. The problem is power. The batteries only run 180 minutes in talk mode, and the keypad sticks when you dial. But that's Mark's headache. We're on schedule with the line.
Good.
He turned to Don Cherry.
And how's the corridor?
Cherry sat back in his chair, beaming. He crossed his hands over his belly. I am pleased to report, he said, that as of half an hour ago, the corridor is fan-fucking-tastic.
Really?
That's great news.
Nobody's throwing up.
Please, ancient history.
End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.